Greetings and grammonitory stipulations, my Fragromycetic listeners, and welcome to this July 2019 Science News Update. I'm your host for this questionably crude and vulgar podcast segment, Jim Campanella. You'll be hearing this July podcast segment in early August, I suspect, because Tony told me he would play it when he got back from his vacation. So you should be blessed? Cursed? With more than one science podcast segment this month. Lucky you. First story of the evening. Cannabis. Well, I was out in Oregon on a family vacation a couple of weeks ago, and was told again and again how out of control cannabis use has gotten. I have nieces and nephews who are in high school telling me how cannabis use has gone up to a great degree since the use of the weed has been legalized there for 21-year-olds. I've been told that the drug has been easy to obtain and is running rampant in high schools. Now, mind you, this is all hearsay, but I find this first story about the genetics of cannabis use very interesting. Is there a genetic predisposition to the use of this drug? Maybe this is the answer. Dr. Ditte DeMontis from Aarhus University reports in Nature Neuroscience last month that she has found a specific gene that is associated with an increased risk of cannabis abuse. The gene is the source of a nicotine receptor in the brain, and people with low levels of this receptor seem to have an increased risk of cannabis abuse. DeMontis says, quote, "We discovered that the disorder was associated with a genetic variant. This variant affects how much of a certain nicotine receptor is formed in the brain. The risk for cannabis use disorder has a strong genetic component, with twin heritability estimates ranging from 51 to 70%. We performed a genome-wide association study of cannabis use disorder in 2,387 cases and 48,000 controls. We report a genome-wide significant risk locus for cannabis use disorder that replicates in an independent population," unquote. The genetic variant discovered by DeMontis affects how many copies of a specific nicotine receptor is formed. People who have fewer of this receptor in the brain seem to be at greater risk of becoming cannabis abusers. DeMontis and her colleagues used a nationwide Danish cohort to analyze the complete genome of more than 2,000 cannabis abusers and the genome of close to 50,000 control subjects, as she said. The researchers subsequently repeated these findings in an analysis with a further 5,500 cannabis abusers and more than 300,000 control subjects. DeMontis also included genetic data from studies in which researchers examined underlying genetics for cognition, like the ability to complete an education. She found that people with a higher number of genetic variants associated with impaired cognition also have an increased risk of cannabis abuse. So impaired cognition leads to cannabis use? Can't you rephrase this? Could you say, "Only a fool would take drugs," as Mr. T would say. DeMontis continues with, quote, "People who abuse cannabis often do worse in the education system, and our results show that this can be partly explained by genetics. That is to say that people with an abuse problem have more genetic variations in the genome, which increase the risk of cannabis abuse, while at the same time negatively affecting their ability to get an education," unquote. Sounds like a seriously vicious cycle to me. The students probably start to abuse cannabis because they're having problems with school, and this makes their grades worse, which leads to more drug use, which leads to more failure in school, etc., etc., etc. Next story. Teleportation. Well, quantum teleportation. So we've discussed the concept of quantum teleportation previously. This is where there are two particles that are quantumly entangled and that information from one particle can be instantly transferred to the other, no matter what the distance is. Again, because of this weird concept of quantum entanglement, they can affect each other. In the June issue of the journal Communication Physics, Dr. Hideo Kosaka of Yokohama National University and colleagues report teleporting quantum information securely within the confines of a diamond. The study has big implications for quantum information technology, the future of how sensitive information is shared and stored. So why is this important? Kosaka says, quote, "Quantum teleportation permits the transfer of quantum information into an otherwise inaccessible space. It also permits the transfer of information into a quantum memory without revealing or destroying the stored quantum information," unquote. The inaccessible space in this case consisted of carbon atoms in a diamond. Made of linked yet individually contained carbon atoms, a diamond holds the perfect ingredients for quantum teleportation. A carbon atom stores 6 protons and 6 neutrons in its nucleus, surrounded by 6 spinning electrons. As the atoms bond into a diamond, they form a notoriously strong lattice. We all know that diamond is the strongest natural substance there is. Diamonds can have complex defects, though. When a nitrogen atom exists in one of 2 adjacent vacancies where the carbon atoms should be, this defect is called a nitrogen vacancy center. Surrounded by carbon atoms, the nucleus structure of the nitrogen atom creates what Kosaka calls a nanomagnet. To manipulate an electron and a carbon isotope in that vacancy, Kosaka and his team attached a wire about 1/4 of the width of a human hair to the surface of a diamond. They applied a microwave and a radio wave to the wire to build an oscillating magnetic field around the diamond. They shaped the microwave to create the optimal control conditions for the transfer of quantum information within the diamond. Kosaka then used the nitrogen nanomagnet to anchor an electron. Using microwave and radio waves, Kosaka forced the electron to spin to entangle with a carbon nuclear spin. Once the two pieces are entangled, meaning their physical characteristics are so entwined that they can't be described individually, a photon which holds quantum information is applied, and the electron absorbs the photon. The absorption allows the polarization state of the photon to be transferred into the carbon, which is then mediated by the entangled electron, demonstrating a teleportation of information at the quantum level. This is how Kosaka describes it in his paper. If you understand that all perfectly, then more power to you. I am a biologist with some background in chemistry, but it is a bit opaque as to exactly what Kosaka means by his explanation. At least it's opaque to me. Kosaka further says, quote, "The success of the photon storage in the other node establishes the entanglement between 2 adjacent nodes. Using a series of quantum repeaters, the process can take individual chunks of information from node to node across a quantum field. Our ultimate goal is to realize scalable quantum repeaters for long-haul quantum communications and distributed quantum computers for large-scale quantum computation and metrology," unquote. Onwards and upwards. From the confusion of quantum physics to the weird and confusing idea of virtual taste? Huh? We are certainly familiar with the idea that vision and hearing can be fooled by virtual computer synthesis. But on the horizon, the other senses will soon be challenged, starting with, yes, taste of all strange things. Dr. Carlos Ribeiro, head of the Behavior and Metabolism Lab at the Center for the Unknown in Lisbon, Portugal. This is not the first time, by the way, that we've talked about the Center for the Unknown. But in this case, They are doing work that will blow your mind. It was just reported last month in the online journal eLife. So a fly in Ribeiro's lab is starving and has not eaten in days. The fly finds a pile of edible gelatinous goo. And the stuff is basically tasteless. Okay, and the fly ignores it because it's tasteless. But suddenly a green light appears and the fly begins eating. And what tasted like nothing a moment ago is now irresistibly sweet to the fly. The fly, excited by the sudden taste improvement, eats with increased vigor. But its enthusiasm quickly wanes when the green light disappears and the flavor of the food reverts to its original blandness. Pretty bizarre, huh? But what is going on is entirely in the little tiny brain of the fly. Ribeiro explains, says, quote, "The fly's experience was very real. It was a virtual taste created by directly manipulating its taste neurons. My team has developed the Optopad, which is a system that creates virtual taste realities in a way that can be flexibly paired with the fly's behavior. The Optopad combines two high-tech elements. The first is optogenetics, a powerful method that uses light to control the activity of neurons, and quite literally turn those neurons on and off. For instance, the fly from earlier was briefly enjoying nummy food because its sweet-sensing neurons were optogenetically activated by exposure to green light. The second element of this work is the Optopad. This is an additional system previously developed in their lab, and it's called the Fly Optopad. Ribeiro says, quote, "The Flypad uses touchscreen-type technology to monitor the fly's feeding behavior. Just like your phone is able to detect the touch of your finger on the screen, Flypad is able to detect whenever the fly touches the food," unquote. By combining Flypad with optogenetics, the researchers were able to overcome one of the main challenges in the field of feeding research, precisely controlling taste sensations. Unlike auditory or visual information, which can be altered instantaneously and independently of the animal's behavior from the outside, animals only experience taste information when they voluntarily touch the food with their tongues, or proboscis in the case of the fly. Ribeiro further explains, quote, "With Optopad, we are constantly monitoring the behavior of the fly to ensure that we optogenetically change the taste of the food precisely when the fly is in contact with it," unquote. The taste that is tasted by the fly is quite real to it. The fly does not know the difference from real tastes. Ribeiro and his team are able to make the fly eat excessively by optogenetically activating sweet-sensing neurons, or make the fly stop eating altogether, regardless of how hungry it is, by optogenetically activating bitter-sensing neurons by changing the wavelength of light, from green to red, for example. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, imagine, if you will, a scenario where you are given bland-tasting but very healthy food, and your brain is manipulated to believe that it tastes nummy beyond belief. That is a fantastic way to improve one's nutrition without compromising taste. This is a wonderful scenario for those of us who have struggled with weight and nutrition for years. This seems kinda obvious. However, Ribeiro's goal is to improve human life in more fundamental ways. He says, quote, "The food we eat affects all aspects of our lives, including aging, the ability to reproduce, lifespan, mental state, and mood. Yet, how the brain controls food choice is still a mystery. The Optopad can help us identify the neurons and genes that will have a direct impact on nutrition and hence our well-being in the years to come," unquote. Well, Should I even mention the Matrix at this point and coming one step closer to the reality of it? What was it that the character Cypher said in that very first Matrix movie?
Do we have a deal, Mr. Reagan?
You know, I know this steak doesn't exist. I know that when I put it in my mouth, the Matrix is telling my brain that it is juicy and delicious. After 9 years, you know what I realize? Ignorance is bliss.
Just a bit chilling, ain't it? Thanks, Dr. Ribeiro. I think. I'm truly not sure what to think of the next story, because it seems like another one of those microbiome stories that says our guts control everything. Well, Dr. Alexander Kostick of Harvard University reported this month in the journal Nature Medicine that apparently elite athletes have better, different, more elite microbiomes than the rest of us schmucks. I guess that means that their poop literally doesn't stink. I'm not quite sure what it means. Previous studies have shown that exercise is linked with changes to athletes' microbiomes, but the effects of these changes aren't known. To investigate whether specific gut bacteria might be linked with athletic performance and recovery, Kostick took daily stool samples from 15 athletes who ran in the 2015 Boston Marathon and analyzed them to see which bacteria were present. Stool samples from the runners were collected and analyzed every day for a week before the marathon, and then again daily for a week after the marathon. And then you wonder why I'm a plant biologist. Ugh. Anyway, the analytical results were compared with those from fecal samples taken from sedentary individuals. Ha, sedentary. I think that's code for normal people who do not do idiotic things like run marathons. Anyway, Kostick found that a species of bacteria called Vilonella were far more abundant in the runners' poop samples post-marathon than they were pre-marathon, and were also more prevalent among runners than among non-runners. He says, quote, "One of the things that immediately caught our attention was this single organism, Vilonella, that was clearly enriched in abundance immediately after the marathon and the runners. Vilonella is also at higher abundance in marathon runners in general than it is in sedentary individuals," unquote. Again, sedentary equals normal and lazy. The study included an analysis of stool samples from an independent cohort of 87 ultramarathon runners and Olympic trial rowers, both before and after exercise, and the results confirmed the increased abundance of Vilonella post-exercise in them as well. Here's a bit of biology I teach to introductory classes, which you may know. When mammals undergo anaerobic metabolism, that is, they force their muscles to work when there's not enough oxygen, they start to make a toxin called lactic acid instead of actually making much energy, that is, ATPs. Lactic acid is one reason that our muscles ache horrendously after a heavy workout. Well, it turns out that the Vilonella species, which are in such high concentrations in elite athletes, use lactic acid, lactate, as their primary food source, which they metabolize into harmless molecules. So it seems feasible Vilonella-related improvements in exercise performance might be related to the bacterium's ability to remove excess lactic acid, so that elite athlete muscles do not start to go south like the rest of us during extreme exercise. Kostick finishes with, quote, Our study is the first to directly demonstrate a strong example of symbiosis between microbes and their human host. This is a really important example of how the microbiome has evolved ways to become this symbiotic presence in the human host. The microbiome is such a powerful metabolic engine. It's very clear. It creates this positive feedback loop. The host is producing something that this particular microbe favors, then in return, the microbe is creating something that benefits the host. Unquote. All right, we're going to finish the evening with a couple of dog stories. First, there's a new study that suggests liking dogs may actually have a genetic component. A new study out of Uppsala University has found that one of the big reasons that dog owners own dogs may literally be found in their blood. Researchers in Sweden studied over 35,000 pairs of twins and discovered that people's propensity to care for canines has a lot more to do with DNA and genetics than we previously thought. The work was performed in the lab of Dr. Patrick Magnusson. It was published in the journal Scientific Reports this month. Dogs were the first domesticated animal and have had a close relationship with humans for at least 30,000 years. Today, dogs are common pets in our society and are considered to increase the well-being and health of their owners. The team compared the genetic makeup of twins using the Swedish Twin Registry, the largest of its kind in the world, with dog ownership. Magnusson says, quote, "We were surprised to see that a person's genetic makeup appears to be a significant influence in whether they own a dog. As such, these findings have major implications in several different fields related to the understanding of dog-human interaction throughout history and in modern times. Although dogs and other pets are common household members across the globe, little is known about how they impact our daily life and health. Perhaps some people have a higher innate propensity to care for a pet than others." Unquote. I know I don't. I'm a cat person, and that's probably simply because I am lazy, or wait, sedentary, that's the word. I do not want to walk a dog morning, noon, and night. I do not want to constantly baby an animal. I've got kids. I don't want another kid. It just makes your life more complicated, and my life is complicated enough, let me tell you. Cats are awesome because they take care of themselves 90% of the time. You clean the litter box and feed them, and they are quite happy and will kill any unfortunate rodent that wanders into your house. Cats are low maintenance. Dogs are way too high maintenance. The thought of walking a dog in the middle of winter at 7:30 a.m. does not fill me with any kind of joy. Anyway, studying twins is a well-known method used by geneticists for disentangling the influences of environment and genes on our biology and behavior, or nature versus nurture, as it's sometimes called. Because identical twins share their entire genome, and non-identical twins, on average, share only half of the genetic variation, comparisons of the within-pair concordance of dog ownership between groups can reveal whether genetics plays a role in owning a dog. The researchers found concordance rates of dog ownership to be much larger in identical twins than in non-identical ones, supporting the view that genetics indeed plays a major role in the choice of owning a dog. Magnusson states, quote, "These kinds of twin studies cannot tell us exactly which genes are involved, but they at least demonstrate for the first time that genetics and environment play about equal roles in determining dog ownership. The next obvious step is to try to identify which genetic variants affect this choice, and how they relate to personality traits and other factors like allergy." Decades of archaeological research have helped us construct a better picture of where and when dogs entered into the human world. But modern and ancient genetic data are now allowing us to directly explore why and how, unquote. And now the second dog story of the night. It appears that because dogs have evolved so close to humans, that there has been a selection process to make them appear more emotional and empathic to us.
Raggy, rushy ran, rhyme like rumens? Roar!
Yeah, Scoob, you're just like humans. So dogs, more than almost any other domesticated species, are desperate for human contact. Seriously, stare at a cat. It will look away. It will not meet your gaze. I've tried this before. Cats are threatened by your staring them directly in the eyes, and they will perceive you as a danger. Dogs, however, begin fighting for our attention when they're as young as 4 weeks old. It's hard for most people to resist a petulant flash of puppy dog eyes. That appears to be how we like it, because we have selected for those traits over the last 30,000 years. A paper published last month in the Proceedings in the National Academy of Sciences from the lab of Dr. Julianne Kaminsky of the University of Portsmouth found that dogs' faces are structured for complex expression in a way that wolves aren't, thanks to a special pair of muscles that frame their eyes. These muscles are responsible for that adopt me look that dogs can pull by raising their inner eyebrows. It's the first biological evidence scientists have found that domesticated dogs might have evolved a specialized ability used expressly to communicate better with humans. For the study, Kaminsky's team looked at two muscles that work together to widen and open a dog's eyes, causing them to appear bigger, droopier, and objectively cuter. The retractor anguli oculi lateralis muscle and the levator anguli oculi medialis muscle, mercifully shortened to RAOL and LAOM. These muscles form two short straight lines, which connect the ring of muscles around a dog's eye to either end of the brow above. Kaminsky has long been interested in the way dogs make eye contact with humans, and in particular, how they move their eyebrows. In 2017, she found that dogs move their eyebrows more often while a human paid attention to them, and less often when they were ignored or given food. That suggested that they could control this movement. As far as humans are concerned, research has also shown that when dogs work these muscles, humans respond more positively, and both man and mutt benefit from a jolt of oxytocin when locked in on each other, eye to eye. And this ain't just by chance. Kaminsky hypothesized it's likely that dogs develop their skill for eyebrow manipulation because of their connection to humans. If true, one way to tell would be to look for that same capacity in wolves, because dogs split off from their wolf relatives, specifically gray wolves, as long as about 33,000 years ago. So that studying the two animals is a little like cracking open a four-legged time capsule. And so what's the result? In four gray wolves that Kaminsky looked at, neither muscle was present. Sorry, Jon Snow. Shadow, the dire wolf, will never be as expressive as a chihuahua. In five of the six breeds of dogs the researchers looked at, both muscles were fully formed and strong. By evolutionary standards, the time since dogs and wolves split from each other has been remarkably short for two new facial muscles to have developed. For a species to change that fast, a pretty powerful selection force had to be acting on it. And that's where we come in. As usual, we are the chumps. We have always been the best creature on this planet to manipulate the world around us. And sometimes it's manipulated for good, and sometimes not so good. Humans connect profoundly with animals capable of exaggerating the size and width of their eyes, which makes them look like our own human babies. And it hijacks our nurturing instincts. Think of Mickey Mouse, or Bugs Bunny, or Scooby-Doo, or for that matter, any beloved cartoon character. They have all been babified by artists in order to help us fall in love with them. Long before animation or even drawing emerged in human conscience, we were unknowingly manipulating dogs to our own ends. Research has already demonstrated that humans prefer pets with more infant-like facial features. 2 years ago, Kaminsky showed that dogs who made the facial movements that were read as distinctly human-like were more likely to be selected for adoption from a shelter than those who didn't. We might not have bred dogs with this trait knowingly, but they gained so much from having it that it became a widespread facial feature. Kaminsky states, quote, "These muscles evolved during domestication, but almost certainly due to an advantage they gave dogs during interactions with humans that we humans have been all but unaware of. A big theme that's come out again and again in canine cognition and looking at the domestication of dogs is that it seems likely that they really just kind of dove right into our society in the role of being an infant or a small child in a lot of ways. We treat them like babies, and they have thrived by co-opting the existing systems we have for interacting with our young," unquote. Blah. So in short, we have created our own cutesy, baby-like monsters. Ugh. I suppose that dog lovers may not find this as deeply disturbing as I do, but I do find it greatly disconcerting. Well, that's all from me for now. If you love that dog, have a real baby and ignore everything you learned watching Lady and the Tramp, especially about Siamese cats. Remember, that steak on your plate may not be real. Keep watching the skies, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.